The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 336, Your Tithing Dollars at Work, the LDS Church's Political Campaign Against Same-Sex Marriage Rights. A panel including Dwight Cook, James Cartwright, Roger Leishman, and Jay Stevens.
Any minute, I guess. I want to welcome you today to, on behalf of Sunstone, to this morning's panel entitled Your Tithing Dollars at Work, the Political Agenda of the LDS Church Against Same-Sex Marriage. I want to start by introducing and talking about our panelists just a little bit. All of these people have come from far away at their own expense to be able to sit on the panel today. First off, we have Jay Stevens. And let's see, looking at his resume, I think the quickest way of talking about Jay Stevens is that he's qualified. Jay has a Bachelor's of Science from BYU, a Master's of Science, and a PhD from the University of Maryland. He's currently a professor of political science at California State University in Long Beach. He's been a visiting professor at several universities and has published in several journals. He's been appointed for administrative appointments as Associate VP of Academic Affairs. He's Dean of the Graduate Studies. He was appointed Dean of Graduate Studies and Associate Dean of College of Social and Behavior Sciences at California State University in Long Beach. He served a mission in Southern Australia, High Priest Group Leader, and he's currently a member of the Board of Directors of the Orange County Gay and Lesbian Community Center. And he also wanted us all to know that he is not a member of any organized political party. He's a Democrat. You people who are sitting on the other side of the room over there may want to wander over this way if you get a chance, because we will be showing overheads and you may not be able to see them real well from over there. Next on our panel we have Jim Cartwright, or as we affectionately call him, Marion the Librarian. He's got a Bachelor of Arts and a Master's of Arts in English from BYU. He has an MS of Library Science at the University of California, Berkeley. And he's currently university archivist at the University of Hawaii, and he served a mission in the West Spanish American Mission. Okay. Finally, we have Roger Leishman. Roger attended BYU as a Spencer W. Kimball Scholar. He graduated summa cum laude. Did I say that right? Is that loud? Okay. Well, I knew you were loud, but with a BA in English. And while at BYU, he was one of the founding editors of the Student Review. He got his Doctors of Jurisprudence from Yale University Law School, and he practiced law in Seattle, and now he's currently director of Gay and Lesbian Rights Projects at the ACLU in Illinois. He also served a mission in Seoul, Korea. And he wanted us all to know that his greatest achievement in life was when Jeffrey Holland stated that Roger was one of his greatest disappointments. Again, we'll go in that order. I'm Dwight Cook, and I have the dubious pleasure of being both moderator and presenter on today's panel. And I'll start by giving just a brief history of some things that you may not know or generally aren't known with regards to same-sex marriage, a little bit of a background, and then I will talk specifically about my home state of Arizona and what has happened there. I also should note that we're going to concentrate, we're all going to talk about same-sex marriage and the political issues around that, except Roger informed me this morning that he was going to talk about everything but same-sex marriage, so I'm not sure exactly what he's going to be doing. We're going to be discussing outside of the state of Utah, because other sessions have pretty much covered the state, what's happened inside of the state of Utah. Okay. I'll start by talking about the definition of marriage. Okay, despite how deeply rooted and traditional the modern definition of marriage is thought to be, it doesn't take a lot of research to realize the relatively short-term nature of any definition of marriage in any period of history. Marriage has at times been simply a transfer of ownership, mostly of the woman to the man. At times, it was available only to aristocracy. common people simply shacked up. And even biblical matrimony was anything but consistent and certainly different from how we view matrimony today. As many people are reluctantly aware, the prophet Solomon was married to 700 women and carried on the side another 300 concubines. Okay. Renowned historian John Boswell has shown that in several cases, religiously sanctioned and celebrated marriage unions between people of the same sex existed in Judeo-Christian history to the same extent that they existed for people of opposite sex. And it also is important to note that these relationships were not only recognized in Judeo-Christian history, but also by many non-Western cultures. Boswell cites Japan, Africa, American Indians, ancient Russian history, and South America. The recognition and celebration of same-sex relationships is nothing new. On the other hand, marriage rites have throughout history been used as a means to segregate classes, outlawing or punishing marriage with certain classes altogether or among classes. Examples of this certainly include the caste system in India, the racial history of the United States. In fact, it wasn't until 1962 that interracial marriages were even legal in the state of Arizona. Likewise, under Hitler, Jewish Germans were not allowed to have their marriages certified by the state. And most closely paralleled to our current situation was the treatment of marriage during the religious wars of the 17th century in England, where people were denied recognition of their relationships based simply upon their religious beliefs. This brings us to today's situation and in my own state of Arizona. And to give you a bit of background of Arizona, Arizona is characterized by a defiant attitude of don't tell us what to do. I'm reminded of Roger Leishman in that regard. In fact, driven by its rugged landscape and climate and history, Arizona remains the only state where no matter which way you enter the state, you find millions of middle finger gestures waiting for you as you cross the landscape. Most people think of Arizona with a little bit of a grin. Most recently, they think of our recent indictment of our governor on 23 counts of fraud, false statements to federal banks, and attempted extortion, with more indictments likely to come. They also think of the Martin Luther King Day fiasco a few years ago, and some might even add to that list the indictment of LDS Governor Evan Minkham, making Arizona only one of two states had two governors indicted. But the fact of the matter, if you look at Arizona history, these types of things have been there forever and ever. And I have lots of examples, but I'm not going to go into them. Demographically, the state is no more than 7% LDS. Several rural areas are predominantly LDS, and the Phoenix suburb of Mesa is so dominated by LDS church that it is often referred to as Little Salt Lake City. The LDS cultural influence is as disproportionately large as is its political influence. Nearly one-third of the Republicans elected to office are LDS. In addition, there are large numbers of LDS people that work in the state and legislative offices. While nearly all of these individuals are extremely right-wing on the political spectrum, okay, they vary greatly in the way that they carry their religion with them, ranging from those that downplay their membership in the LDS church to those that that proudly proclaim their religion ad nauseum, much to the annoyance of their fellow legislators from both sides of the aisle. The stage was set for the current intensiveness of the same-sex marriage issue during the gubernatorial campaign of 1994. Running against incumbent Fife Symington was Eddie Basha, a popular Democrat who operates a large chain of grocery stores bearing his name. Plagued by his growing financial scandal and a relatively unpopular first time, Governor Symington found it rather difficult to gain the edge over Democratic candidate Basha, despite the predominant or huge majority of Republicans in the state. But Symington's chance came when Basha granted an interview with the local gay and lesbian magazine, The Echo. Symington campaign aides secretly began circulating copies of the interview in the most conservative districts in and around Mesa. This quickly garnered the attention of the news media, and Basha was soon painted as a possible supporter of gay marriage. Given the announcement by the First Presidency earlier that same year, LDS church members by the thousands concluded that a blatantly dishonest governor was better than a governor who might possibly be supportive of same-sex marriages. Symington narrowly beat Basha, and the gay marriage issue was given the credit by many political analysts. 1996 found the Arizona Republican Party with similar difficulties. Drained heavily by Symington's unpopularity and pending indictment, Republicans needed a wedge issue. Hoping to repeat the apparent success of Governor Symington's 1994 strategy, Republican leaders turned to the issue of same-sex marriage. But to the surprise of many, the majority of legislators recognized it for the redundant and mean-spirited act it was, and the first three attempts to pass it failed. Determined to find a way to comply with the dictates of their religious leaders, LDS legislators and their right-wing allies found new ways to resurrect the issue and then were defeated each time. Desperate for support in the face of an imminent indictment, Governor Symington allegedly made a deal with LDS Speaker of the House, Mark Killian. The alleged deal would ensure Symington's support for the bill and that Symington would in turn have the support of key Republicans after his indictment. Just a few weeks before his formal indictment, Symington told listeners of his radio show that issues like lobbying reform were small potatoes compared to the importance of banning same-sex marriages. Through clear manipulation of the rules, a fourth attempt was made and a new bill was brought to the House floor. With the governor's urging, it eventually passed. LDS legislators praised the act, and in reality, given the LDS influence in Arizona, it would have been a major embarrassment to the church had it not passed. Understanding that Arizona law already explicitly defined marriage as between a male person and a female person, and that it explicitly stated one could not travel to another state to get around Arizona marriage law, the passage of Senate Bill 1038 had little or no legal meaning. And as far as I can tell by my reading of the bill, and I'm not a lawyer, but the only legal effect this bill had was to deny any recognition of marriages between first cousins, which prior to Senate Bill 1038 would have been recognized in Arizona if they were originally licensed in another state. Now, this means that Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt's marriage would probably not be recognized in Arizona today, but Eleanor probably would have been happier anyway. Many legislators promised gay and lesbian citizens that they would not be the one vote that made this bill pass. As one moderate Republican legislator told me, "I saw the message of hate that this bill sent. I knew it was just a power play. I knew it was totally unnecessary. But I knew that my constituency, mostly Mormons, would not see it that way." And I paraphrase what a reporter on the Horizon show said. The Horizon Show is a nightly PBS program dedicated specifically to state news. And he said, "Despite what they think is motivating this bill, they don't want to go back to their districts being seen as having voted for same-sex marriage." Now, there is honestly a conflicting opinion about whether or not this bill would have passed without the LDS influence. Several people I interviewed commented that had the Speaker of the House not been LDS and been a more strict follower of parliamentary rules, the bill would not have been introduced multiple times. And certainly the LDS votes were enough to swung the decision in either way. But regardless, it did pass and was interpreted as a message, as just another message of hate by Arizonans, lesbian and gay citizens. Now, in addition to this most recent legislative action against gays and lesbians, Arizona still has a sodomy law on the books and has also made it very clear that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is very legal. 1995, our legislature passed a law that prohibits school districts from portraying homosexuality as a positive alternative lifestyle, thus giving Arizona one of the most restrictive state laws against unbiased education in the nation. And marriage rights were not the only gay and lesbian issue to be addressed by Arizona legislature this year. If you take all of the gay and lesbian related issues and break down the positive votes over the total votes cast, and then average that over religions, you find that out of all the religions, LDS legislatures by far and away vote the most homophobic. You can see by looking at this that the Catholic Church, which has also come out vocally against same-sex marriage, you know, had an extremely good record on all gay and lesbian issues. In fact, 7 of the Catholic representatives voted against the ban on same-sex marriage. Likewise, even the Christian denominations, which we tend to think of along with the Christian Coalition or Concerned Women for America, had a much better record in their voting than do the LDS legislators. Okay. One of the most significant events or achievements for Arizona lesbians and gays, as well as many other minorities this year, was the passage of a hate crime sentencing act that included sexual orientation. Again, apparently in an effort to secure support of key Republicans who had opposed the bill, Symington vetoed the hate crimes bill. LDS legislator Jeff Groskopf probably echoed the feeling of the majority of the LDS legislators who had opposed the bill when he told the Arizona Republic he was glad Symington vetoed the bill and then explained why. Once they, gays and lesbians, are recognized, they could go to the courts and say they should be recognized in other sections of the law. To me, this is the proverbial camel's nose under the tent. The power of the word spoken from community leaders such as this individual can only be fully understood by looking at their enactment in the form of hate crimes, which this bill sought to prevent. Hate crimes continue to rise in Arizona. As an example, just a few days after Jeff Groskopf made this statement, a 42-year-old gay man was shot coming out of a gay bar by 3 men in a red Suzuki Samurai who were yelling, "Faggot." As part of his efforts to get the bill passed, Representative Tom Smith told the Associated Press with regards to same-sex marriage, "I can't think of anything more disgusting." Mormon Representative Rusty Bowers turned the House debate floor into what sounded like a fast and testimony meeting when he read from Corinthians and implied that God would not help Arizona in the future if they did not pass this ban on same-sex marriages. About that same time, lesbians were celebrating a birthday when they were assaulted, putting one of them in the hospital with a coma. Okay. Again, coming from the floor debate on Senate Bill 1038, Representative Robert Blendu compared same-sex marriages with marrying a cow or a cabbage. He implied that legalizing same-sex marriage would lead to the financial ruin of the state because fathers would all marry sons in order to avoid inheritance taxes. The words coming from Arizona state leaders are only a reflection of the words coming from the pulpit of the churches in their districts and from the leaders of those churches. Elder Packer's "Someone Had to Do It" speech finds itself realized in the streets of Mesa. On March 31, 1996, not far from Mr. Groskopf's district, Andrew Rogers and his girlfriend shared an innocent kiss in his car as they drove home. Unbeknownst to them, 2 men in the car next to them watched in horror, believing that it was 2 men kissing. The 2 men got out of their car and began attacking the couple's car while screaming anti-gay epithets. Rogers got out of the car and tried to stop the 2 men. He was subsequently beaten until his girlfriend got out of the car and the assailant saw that she was actually a woman. More seriously yet, last September, Kathy Ackers, a Mesa resident, was severely beaten in her home by Jim J. Ledford while he was screaming, "Lesbian bitch, I'm going to kill you. All lesbians should be killed." Before Ledford was done, Ackers had a subdural cranial hematoma, a smashed cheekbone, broken ribs, her lips split all the way up her cheek, and was missing 7 teeth. Ackers lived after extensive brain surgery and is permanently deaf in one ear. She's losing eyesight and losing memory, all stemming from Ledford's attack. During his interrogation, Ledford told police, "I don't normally hit women, but this lesbian isn't even a person." On November 14th, 18-year-old James Lutz hung himself just 1 week after he came out to his mother. On June 3rd last year, 25-year-old Mark Sauer, an LDS gay man, was shot after the assailant told him, "We don't want you guys around here. We don't like what you do." Sauer later died as a result of complications of those gunshot wounds. In 1995, there were 84 cases of gay bias-related crimes in Arizona, including 31 assaults and at least 3 murders. According to Lyle Miller of the Anti-Violence Project of the Valley of the Sun Gay and Lesbian Community Center, the 1996 Arizona figures will follow the national trend and be much greater this year, due directly to the anti-gay rhetoric spewing forth from campaigning politicians. Just a few weeks ago, there was another gay bias-related murder just a couple of miles from my own home. In some ways, I feel like I am in a war zone. But indeed, there is no place that I can hide. There is no place for anyone to hide. The LDS church leaders may or may not have started the violence, but one thing is clear. They are doing nothing, absolutely nothing, to stop it. And the rhetoric of their members in running for public office clearly heightens it. The very church that raised me and taught me that violence was wrong is now a prime instigator in violence. Faithful Mormons, thinking they are doing only what their leaders want them to do, spread the rhetoric of hate abundantly, and ultimately it expresses itself in violence in Arizona and across the nation. Dr. Stevens.
This is my first appearance at Sunstone, and I'm scared to death. I'm worried that I'm going to end in the name of Jesus Christ, amen. The action in California really is, as everywhere else, a reaction to Hawaii. After the Republicans finally took control of the state assembly in September of 1995, Assembly Bill 1982 was introduced to prevent the state of California from recognizing same-sex marriage as solemnized anyplace else, and to define marriage as a relationship between a man and a woman. Right after that, as the bill was coming to be voted on by the state assembly, I should tell you the state assembly is Republican and the state senate is Democratic. And the issue of same-sex marriages in California is very much a partisan issue. Just before the vote was taken on the floor of the assembly on same-sex marriages, the North America West Area Presidency sent a directive to all the wards and branches in the state of California indicating the church's position on marriage and concluding that letter by saying, "It has been brought to our attention that Assembly Bill 1982 that would prohibit California from recognizing same-sex marriages legalized in other states has been favorably reported out of committee in the California legislature and will be coming forward to a full vote on Wednesday, January 31st, 1996. Any effort that members acting as individual citizens can make to contact their own legislators in support of this measure would be in harmony with the church's proclamation on the family." That was the opening salvo in terms of the church's political campaign in California. It was anticipated that the Senate would take up the bill after it was passed in the Assembly in March at the request of the bill sponsor, Pete Knight, Republican from Palmdale. The bill was not taken up and postponed. It was supposed to be taken up in April. It was again postponed. He simply didn't have the votes to get a favorable due pass recommendation from the Senate Judiciary Committee because it was controlled by the Democratic Party. The church's program and campaign in California was kind of interesting because all of a sudden there became directives in many of the wards and stakes in California. And I don't know how many. I haven't been able to trace this down. And my suspicion is that the directives were given only to stakes in which they were near or in a senatorial district that was represented by a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. In one ward in the San Gabriel Valley, messages and papers were handed out to instruct the saints that they were to write a particular senator, in this case, Senator Hilda Solis, who was a Democrat from the 24th Senatorial District, and she was supposed to be contacted to persuade her to vote in favor of reporting out AB 1982. Not only were the saints indicated they were supposed to write to her, but they were also given form letters and points that they were to be included in their letter. The information that was passed out in church includes this kind of interesting statement. Our local state senator is Hilda Solis, Democrat, 24th District. Contact her office in support of this bill is to be made by letter, email, or phone by individual constituents only. No representation of the church is to be expressed or implied. Form letters and postcards will not be tallied by her office. In each of these efforts, the church has gone out of its way to say you're doing this as individual citizens, and this is not a concerted effort by the church. It would seem to me that that statement lacks just a tiny bit of candor. In addition to this, there is a sample letter telling the people exactly what they're supposed to write. Once again, the consideration of AB 1982 was postponed. It wasn't taken up by the Senate Judiciary Committee until July of 1996. And in that consideration, all of a sudden, the same directives were issued to stakes in the Bay Area, or at least one stake that I'm aware of. That stake in the Bay Area is on the East Bay Area. And it just so happened that two members of the Senate Judiciary Committee represented districts that were fairly near to that particular stake. I do not believe the church has sent out such directives to all the wards and branches and stakes in California. I think there was a concerted attempt to try and influence the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I believe that for a very simple reason, that once AB 1982 gets to the floor of the Senate for a full vote, the Senate probably will support it and pass it. Difficulty is getting the thing reported out of committee, where you have a number of Democrats who can act, vote their conscience, as opposed to worrying very much about their constituents. Has the campaign of the church been terribly effective? As a political scientist, I guess what I would say is no. And it's not been effective for a number of reasons. The first reason is, I brought my visual aids along today too. AB 1982 composes that particular paragraph. That's all it says. Simply amends the law to indicate that same-sex marriages will not be recognized. Democrats on the Judiciary Committee amended the bill. This is the amendment that came out of the Judiciary Committee. It is 34 pages long. And what it does is it amends the educational code, it amends the family code, it amends the government code, the health and safety code, the insurance code, and the probate code. And what the amendments do is to continue the original language of the bill that same-sex marriages will not be recognized by California. But the amendments then go on to create domestic partnerships that gives to unmarried people or same-sex unions in California virtually all the rights and prerogatives that married couples have. I don't think the church would like that. As a consequence, there's a real problem as to whether the instructions to support AB 1982 should be continued or not. And everybody all of a sudden is very silent on that standpoint. One quotation from the Los Angeles Times that I wanted to read to you. They're quoting Senator or Assemblyman Knight testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee. With these amendments, you've gutted the bill, Knight told the committee. The amendments would allow California to recognize same-sex relationships as domestic partnerships. with benefits just short of those legally provided in marriage. And that's exactly what the Democratic members of the Senate Judiciary Committee intended to do. And what they were essentially trying to do was to inoculate themselves so they could go back to their constituents and say, we voted against same-sex marriages, as many constituents wrote and asked them to do that. Why would they do that? Well, there's a number of reasons. And I brought some data. I'm a political scientist that feels more comfortable with data, so I'm going to give you a lot of it. The field poll in California shows, for example, that when you look at California statewide, that in terms of California public opinion, overwhelmingly is opposed to the legalization of same-sex marriages. No legislator, Democrat or Republican in their right mind, would therefore vote to legalize same-sex marriages. That was a foregone conclusion. Same-sex marriages would not pass in the state legislature. This shows you the division in California. The next slide I have shows you the partisan division in public opinion. And that is that if you look at the two political parties, 72% of Republicans are opposed to the legalization of same-sex marriages, but if you look at the people who identify themselves as Democrats, it's fairly evenly divided. 45% are opposed, 44% are in favor. And so you can see some real differences within the political parties in California. The other thing that becomes why I think the church was fairly ineffective in terms of what it was doing is because when you look at the partisan division and you begin to understand something about church memberships and partisanship, it should come as no surprise to you that when you look at the partisan division among religious groups, this is based on an American sample, not just California. But you will discover that Mormons are the most Republican of all religious groups in the United States. And as a consequence, Democrats have very little to fear for Mormons. Mormons aren't going to vote for Democrats in the state legislature of California anyway. And so the kind of bills they write to the members of the legislature protesting same-sex marriages, Democrats don't have to worry about. The other thing that's important to understand about California is that in terms of representation, Republicans and Mormons come largely from suburban districts, places like Orange County, San Diego County, and Democrats to a large extent represent urban districts, Los Angeles County, San Francisco County. One of the big differences you find between the parties in the United States is that Republicans increasingly represent married people and suburbanites. The Democratic Party increasingly represents unmarried people and people who live in urban centers. People who live in urban centers are people of color. What's the next thing I want to say? I've forgotten this. See, I'm still worried about saying in the name of Jesus Christ, amen. People of color, single women who are heads of households, and most of all, gays and lesbians. And as a consequence, the two parties in our state represents that very much. If you look at the data that I'm showing you, it's kind of interesting because the most Democratic group are Jews, the most Republican group are Mormons. Even evangelical Christians and mainline Protestants, while they tend to be Republican, are not Republican to the extent that Mormons are. To illustrate this a little bit further, it's kind of interesting to look at voting behavior. Once again, this is based on a national survey. And in terms of this, once again, evangelical Protestants vote Republican just a little bit more than Mormons do. But if you look at white mainline Protestants and you look at white Catholics, in terms of mainline Protestants, the division is fairly evenly between Clinton and Bush in 1992. In terms of white Catholics, the proportion voting for Clinton is substantially higher. And if you look at our brothers and sisters of the Jewish faith, they are overwhelmingly Democratic. Let me just show you one other thing. I've got all this data that I would love to show you, but there isn't time. And one of the things I would like to show you is the social tolerance by religion in the United States. And California is a pretty good microcosm of the entire United States. And this is in terms of accepting or discouraging homosexuality, not just same-sex marriage, but homosexuality in general. And you can find those that are the most discouraging of homosexual behavior tend to be evangelical Protestants followed by Mormons. And then if you look at mainline Protestants and white Catholics, both of those groups tend to be just slightly more in favor of accepting homosexuals in terms of the community. And then again, if you look at my favorite group of all Jews, I'm thinking of converting. They're very accepting. I was showing some data like this in terms of welfare and race by religion. I made a comment to my sister, Jews are the most Christian group in America today. Let me make a couple of more comments about my evaluation of the church's campaign. First of all, I think it's ineffective because what the church is doing is arguing a high moral tone, that it is immoral for same-sex couples to be married. And yet the church, through covert action, has really questionable ethics in terms of trying to influence legislative campaigns. Section 501 of the Nonprofit Code indicates that there should be no substantial influence of legislation by nonprofit organizations. And if you do this, you're likely to jeopardize your tax-exempt status. I'm on the board of directors of a nonprofit organization, and we follow that very, very closely. And I think the church has questionable ethics to, first of all, say that you ought to do this as citizens and you should not make any representation that this is being conducted by the Mormon Church. I don't know that that's illegal. I'm not a lawyer, and I suspect the church has very good lawyers who will argue that's legal. But I do raise serious questions about the ethics of doing that sort of thing. It reminds me a little bit of President Bateman of BYU, who was giving an address and a sermon, I guess, at his inauguration on relative values and how the rest of the world doesn't have relative values, and then he violates the basic and the greatest value of the academic community in terms of not acknowledging the people who he got his ideas from. I've flunked students for doing that same thing, and I pursued it to the point that I've had those students expelled from school. And, of course, we're secular with no moral values. When the church holds itself up as an example to the world, then it seems to me if the church is going to take that kind of a position, then the church really needs to abide by the kind of ethical considerations that the rest of the world expects it to. Increasingly, I think you find in terms of communities like California, where we are increasingly a secular community, that there are serious challenges to organizations that take advantage of nonprofit status in terms of entering in politics. My own view is, why should my tax money be taken to support a political campaign against my interests? Gays and lesbians throughout the country are hardworking people. They're taxpayers. They make their contributions and then have to subsidize donations to a church. That raises questions about that. Is just, as far as I'm concerned, is just simply not something I want to stand for. Recently, there's been filings against the Christian Coalition in terms of the distribution of so-called nonpartisan endorsements or nonpartisan position papers. The challenge has not been brought by gay and lesbians or people who are pro-choice, but by Republicans, who argue that the Christian Coalition is, in fact, making partisan endorsements in terms of handing out those so-called nonpartisan statements and endorsements to members of their churches. And I think what you find in a society of the larger states, such as California, New York, Massachusetts, and some of the larger ones, is that there is less tolerance for that kind of activity in which people shield themselves behind religion and then do things that are really questionable ethically in terms of entering into politics. Now, if that doesn't get me excommunicated, I'm not sure what will. It has one other implication, and that implication is exactly what happens to LDS individuals who seek to be elected to partisan office. The church, like the Catholic Church, is an authoritarian institution. And when it makes positions that are moral and tells the members of the church that they ought to follow the prophet, that suggests that LDS people who are candidates for public office have some obligation to follow the church. In the 1960s, one of the questions raised about President Kennedy when he was running for office, will you follow the Pope or will you follow your elected constituents? And I think that's a legitimate question when LDS people run for office as well. Do you follow the prophet or do you follow the interests of your constituents? That question began to arise in 1968 when George Romney, the governor of Michigan, ran for the presidency. and it was raised in the context of American civil rights. I have a quotation in here from George Romney, if I can find it quickly. I can't find it quickly. Oh, here it is. Governor George Romney of Michigan was often asked how the church's policy regarding the ordination of African Americans to the priesthood would influence his thinking on civil rights. In the 1968 presidential campaign, Governor Romney claimed he would not get involved in the racial question because, quote, church doctrine is not determined by the attitude and expression of individual members. George Romney was somebody who was very supportive of civil rights and took every effort to speak out in terms of the equality of all people. In the in the most recent campaign in Massachusetts for the United States Senate, his son Mitt Romney had the same kind of questions asked of him. And that is, as an official, he had been the state president of the Boston area, as an official of the Mormon Church, does that color your view in terms of abortion? And two members of the church in that campaign raised the issue that as a bishop, Mr. Romney had counseled a woman to go ahead and carry a pregnancy to full term, even though it jeopardized her own health. And some of the feminists in the church in that area raised questions about whether or not Mitt Romney could adequately represent the people of Massachusetts. And his reply on that issue, I think, is my reply, and I think that the position the church should take when it comes to legislation regarding same-sex marriages. Mitt Romney said, "As an official of the church, I did my best to represent the teachings of the church. But when you ask me what I think our society should do, I believe society should allow individuals to do whatever they choose and live by whatever beliefs they have." Romney said, "It is not the role of government to make choices for individuals." Thank you.
Aloha. I'm going to give you just a brief background of the marriage case. I wasn't going to do that. I figured everybody knows, and if they don't, they can come and talk to me afterwards. And I thought, if five people come and talk to me afterwards, I'll be talking till I'm blue. So I'll give it to all of you. In 1991, Nania Bear and Janora Dansell, another lesbian pair, and a gay couple went to apply for a marriage license in the state of Hawaii. They were refused. They went to the American Civil Liberties Union, which, as Roger told me earlier today, had lost this case in several states beforehand. They went to several other attorneys in the city of Honolulu. They got nowhere. Nobody wanted to touch it. And their last straw was a man by the name of Daniel Foley, a former ACLU lawyer in Honolulu, a Haole, a married man, father of two, and a Peace Corps worker in the past, and a Buddhist. And so he said yes, he would take the case. They approached the district court, and it was thrown out. It was not even heard. It was thrown out. So they appealed. In May of 1993, the Supreme Court threw a curveball for the entire United States. And to give you a little bit of background as to how that happened, the state of Hawaii has two clauses in its constitution, the Equal Rights and Protection Clause and the... I had these names all down perfectly, and I wasn't going to have any problems here. Anyway, there's two clauses. Take my word for it. That specifically state that discrimination on the basis of sex is illegal. This differs Hawaii's constitution from the United States Constitution. There is no guarantee there on sexual discrimination. It's totally legal as far as the American Constitution goes. There's no guarantees there. And excuse me. The Hawaii Supreme Court ruled that the reason the state was saying no to these three couples was sex discrimination. So they said to the lower court, you must hear this case, and because it's sex discrimination and that violates our state constitution, you must apply the most rigorous legal terms. This is a suspect class. You must come up with compelling state interest. The state has to be able to continue this discrimination. Dan Foley had not expected to win in the Supreme Court, let alone win this way. He realized that the privacy right had been ruled against us in Bowers versus Hardwick. It was totally legal for a state to violate the privacy of a gay man to enforce its sodomy laws. So, and the Supreme Court had ruled that one. So he was surprised. So were we all. That occurred in May of 1993. If you've got more detail, just a little bit about that. This, therefore, in Hawaii is not a legislative issue. It has become one, but it is not a legislative issue. It is a judicial issue. It will be resolved in our courts if we can keep it out of the legislature. In the spring of 1994, several bills were introduced into the legislature of the state of Hawaii in order to respond to the Supreme Court. Sidelight. We have a two-month legislative session every year. It is a part-time legislature, and it only meets from January through April, so it's 3 or 4 months long, or into the first part of April, and then the legislators go their separate ways and come back the following year. It is a heavily Democratic state. There was a, quote, revolution in 1957 and 54 to 57, in which a very Republican history from annexation until then had been, the territory had been dominated by Republicans. And that was one of the fears of Democratic states in the United States was, if we admit Hawaii, we've just given the Republicans another 2 votes in the Senate. Well, it didn't work out that way. But because we're more Democratic, monolithically Democratic, than Utah is Republican. We have two senators out of 25 in the state Senate that are Republican. We have 3 or 4 Democrats in the House of Representatives, which are 51 in number, that are Republican. The rest of them are Democrat. If you're going to run for office in the state of Hawaii, you'd better change your Mormon propensity towards Republicanism. Okay, now back to the paper. I'm sorry for the sidetracks. Traditionally, the Judiciary Committees in both houses handle amendments to the Constitution. And so when there were other legislature things introduced, some of them not amendments, but just defining, they were assigned to the Judiciary Committees as well. One of the bills would define marriage as between a man and a woman, and the compelling state interest that they needed to come up with was procreation and nurture of children. 20 years ago, in Hawaii, the Democratic legislature had ruled that procreation was not the sole purpose of marriage in order to help reflect equal rights amendment that we had passed and the freedom of choice that belonged with women to control whether or not to carry a child to term and acceptance of abortion. So it was going back in time. I'm so confused, I don't know where to go from here. The church came out against these bills, obviously, and I have gone to the committees in records in the state archives to look for testimony. In 12 February 1994, the Senate Judiciary Committee held hearings open to the public. I went to the House ones on the 2nd and did my first oral testimony. I had written testimony the previous fall, but I was not going to stand up in front of people and say I'm a gay man. So I was still too closeted. In the spring, I did stand up, and I got put on Channel 9's evening news, and the next day people at work said, I saw you on TV last night. And I said, oh. Well, I guess the church knows now, don't they? So it was on both 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock news, and a clip of me saying, I am also Mormon, and et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, Donald Hallstrom, who is the regional representative of the church, submitted testimony to the Senate committee on the 12th of February. He wrote that the church supported those bills which would define marriage as between a man and a woman. But, in my opinion, he oversimplified the role of government, at least government under the American Constitution, when he wrote, the historic and current reasons for a marriage statute are prompted by both religious and governmental motivations. Both institutions have an interest in preserving the established values of their people, and laws are to be reflective of the will of the people. Unquote. Laws are not to be reflective of the will of the people. Laws are to do what is just. Laws are to protect the rights of minorities from the tyranny of the majority. The legislature did pass a bill in 1994 which did affect this issue. It was this bill from the House that would define marriage as between a man and a woman for the procreation of children. But when it got to the Senate, it was not going to succeed in the Senate Judiciary Committee, it didn't seem. But word got around to them that they were going to pull it out of the Senate Judiciary Committee and it would pass the Senate. So the senators on the Judiciary Committee had done some amendment work that Jay talked about. They had called for the establishment of a statewide commission with specified membership that would consider the inequalities between gay and lesbian couples and married couples vis-a-vis the law. This commission was specified of its membership, and people on the committee in the Senate changed their votes to vote yes in order to be on the conference committee to protect the existence of that commission. The commission itself was later ruled, gutted, but it was not ruled unconstitutional. And the next year, the legislature addressed the issue only to correct the problems of that commission. Act 5 of the 1995 legislature reconstructed the commission. It had been a commission of 11 people with 2 members automatically from the Roman Catholic Diocese of Hawaii, 2 members automatically from the LDS Church, 2 members definitely from the American Friends Service Committee, 2 members from the Hawaii Equal Rights Marriage Project, and 2 members from the Hawaii State Civil Rights Commission with an appointed chair coming from the Hawaii Bar Association, chair of the family law section. It had been challenged on the basis of the ties to religions. So Act 5 called for a 7-member committee. 2 members would be selected by the governor from a list of nominees by the chair or by the Speaker of the House. 2 members would be selected by the governor from a list of nominees from the President of the Senate, and the rest of them would be appointed from his own list, and it would have 7 members. The commission began meeting on 13 September 1995 under this new revision and finished their report 8 December. On 6 December, the commission invited public response to the overall findings and to their draft report. It had listened to public comments, heard testimony of invited guests, and accepted written comments during 6 earlier sessions, 13 September, 27 September, 11 October, 25 October, 8 November, and 22 November. The official testimony submitted and given before the commission is not yet available, the end of this month. I wanted it, but it wasn't there. From the report of the commission, however, which is already public and which exists on World Wide Web, and I have on my final page here available some sources and information for you. I can get copies of this for you if you want. It includes the World Wide Web address of the entire report. Of that part of the report, there's a couple of appendices that are not yet done. But it's available if you can get access to the Internet. From the report of the commission, it does not appear that the Mormon Church provided official testimony. The absence of official testimony may stem from a reorientation of the church's approach. Forgive, I couldn't resist that. That a reorientation of the church's approach to the problem. But I'm not sure of that. The Roman Catholic person involved in both of these, Father Mark Alexander, continued to give written report. He and Jack Hoag, who was a former CEO of the Hawaii's, I can't remember the corporation name, but it was our local Zion Securities became very unpopular in La'ie and on Oahu for some of its actions. And so they reorganized the church properties from Zion Securities and gave it a new local name. Jack Hoag was the CEO for a period of time until the church felt they needed more central control and sent somebody from Salt Lake to become the CEO of the new Hawaii organization. Jack Hoag was also on the board of directors of one of the big banks. Jack Hoag is also on the stake high council and the stake that I was a member of. But he wasn't the regional representative. He's a lower profile, and I may get to why that's important. He and a woman who is on the at BYU Hawaii, I don't know what she teaches or what her position is, but I've called her number on campus. I know she's got a campus telephone number. Debbie Hartman became co-chairs along with, and Father Mark Alexander helped also in organizing Hawaii's future today. It is a lobbying organization that tries to defeat same-sex benefits. They testified, though I did not see the church listed as presenting testimony before the commission, Donald Hallstrom did testify to the Senate Judiciary Committee a month or so later on how do you receive this report from the commission. So also did Jack Hoag, Debbie Hartman, an unnamed professor of sociology at BYU Hawaii, provided 22 pages of testimony, considerably homophobic and double talk. And I say unidentified because I do not think he intentionally meant to be hidden. I think the sheet of paper with his name on it merely got separated from the archives copy that's in the archives. I think I know who it is, but I don't know for sure. The church has been opposed to gay marriage. That they would say, as they have, that they support full civil rights is double talk. In the course of 1996, several bills got into the Senate and or into the legislature. And in the course of the situation this past spring, an amendment to weaken the clauses in the Constitution and thereby cut the ground totally out from underneath the case was submitted to the House, and it passed. And it passed well over three votes more than the two-thirds majority needed to go on to the Senate and then go to the populace to be approved. It went to the Senate, was put into the Senate Judiciary Committee. The Senate, in the meantime, had passed a domestic partnership that defined marriage as between a man and a woman and extended to same-sex couples and not heterosexual couples, but same-sex unmarried couples, domestic partnerships guaranteeing most of the rights granted to married couples. It specifically refused to allow adoption rights. They sent it from the Senate to the House, and it was dead. The church testified very definitely against that bill. They did not want to just oppose same-sex marriage. They opposed any kind of rights that would be extended to gay and lesbian couples. I'm going to have to abbreviate. So the last day of the legislature, they tried to pull the bill out of the Judiciary Committee and bring it to the floor. The senator who was chair of another committee who had tried something 3 days early in connection with Jack Hogue and the others, they circumvented public sunshine laws and public announcements. They gutted a bill from the House that was to disbar physicians and osteopaths who had sexual relations with their patients, took the contents out of this licensing bill and said that this licensing bill was to preclude licensing same-sex couples from marrying. They hid the content of this draft until the committee meeting was held. They said that written testimony had to be submitted 24 hours in advance, like is always done. They said there was no written testimony given. Jack Hogue came with papers that he read. He knew what was going on beforehand. He read his testimony, but there was no testimony taken and no minutes taken. They passed it out, put it on the floor of the Senate, and the Senate could have voted for a constitutional amendment that didn't even go through the Judiciary Committee. The President of the Senate sent it to the Judiciary Committee where it died. This same senator, on the last day of the session, got votes to pull the other House amendment out, but he lost. We won 15-10 on two votes, and I could not believe it. I had to pinch myself to see what really happened. Immediately after that, Hawaii's Future Today has been campaigning to take these 14 senators, now 15 in the Senate, who have supported us and put pressure on them. I apologize to Roger. I will hurry. We raised a gay and lesbian political rights action, raised $5,000 to help the person who's challenging that senator. Jack Hogue sponsored a testimonial dinner for that senator. Cost $1,000 a plate. They had 100 guests. In one night, they raised $100,000 to help put that man back in the Senate. He was in jail during the term as his Senate for beating his wife, ex-wife. He has been arrested on DUI, but the Mormon Church will support him because he will campaign and vote against any kind of gay and lesbian rights. Thank you.
I want to continue where Jim talked about some of the shenanigans in Hawaii, because it really is a shocking story. Not merely the interference in the legislative process, and not merely this open political backing of the opponents of these people. The church itself hired the highest profile lobbyist in the state to lobby on behalf of the church against these bills, against the possibility of gay marriage. And most ludicrous of all, the church filed to intervene in the lawsuit about gay marriage. The Catholic Church submitted an amicus brief as a friend of the court with their position, but the Mormon Church, that wasn't enough. They decided they were going to file and be a party because the argument was someday they might be forced to perform marriages, and so they should be in court defending their rights. This is tossed out. It's the most ludicrous thing legally, there's no basis for it. It's an extraordinary interference with the process, advancing completely frivolous claims, but the church took this extraordinary step. What I'd like to talk about this is, as we look at this heavy-handed and ultimately, on the legal side, silly episode by the church, and the less silly but equally heavy-handed political episode in Hawaii, I want to examine one statement by the regional representative Hallstrom, when he announced that the church was filing this lawsuit to intervene in the pending case. He said that the position that they were not there to attack homosexuals or lesbians. Quote, "The position of the church on homosexuality is a matter of record. We are opposed to it on moral grounds. Nevertheless, the church has not attempted to oppose basic civil rights for homosexuals or any other group. This is not our work or our focus. As I told Dwight and Jim and Jay this morning, I don't want to talk about same-sex marriage directly the rest of my time this morning. I want to examine that statement and suggest to you that it is simply not true. And I'll use four or five examples from other episodes in the legal and political gay rights movement today where the church has taken direct and open positions which were intended to oppose basic civil rights for gay men and lesbians. First, I'll come back to this later, but the church, when asked what is its position on these civil rights, has a history of different answers. In 1981, the church's position statement on homosexuality explicitly said, we oppose civil rights, laws against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, because it suggests that gay men and lesbians are a legitimate minority deserving of protection. In the subsequent papers, that was removed. But in the 1995 statement from LDS Social Services, which was discussed yesterday, there actually is another one of these statements where they distinguish homosexuals, people who could be helped if they wanted to, from gay people, who they define as who are happy with their orientation and who are seeking out special legal protections. The church's role in the special rights movement is very interesting. I want to take the most obvious and immediate example is the Colorado case, Evans versus Romer, which was decided by the Supreme Court of the United States this year, the most important decision of the last year in the Supreme Court. In that, the Supreme Court of Colorado had determined that a statewide constitutional amendment which prohibited civil rights protections on the basis of sexual orientation was a violation of the law. The state of Colorado appealed that. And the state of Colorado's lawyer was Rex Lee, who was the sitting president of BYU at the time. I think this is extraordinary. Rex Lee was also a partner of counsel at the firm of Sidley & Austin, a Chicago law firm, which actually many of my two members of my board are partners at Sidley. It's a great law firm. And when Sidley took a lot of heat for this, their response was, We at Sidley don't discriminate. We have domestic partnerships. But we believe that our partners are free to go out and take on whatever causes they want to. They're completely free. Let me come back to the church. The church cannot say that same thing about Rex Lee. Rex Lee, while he was sitting president of BYU, took a very limited number of cases. As all of you know, the church would not let one of its official prominent representatives take such a position in public. The fact that they would let one of their point people be the lawyer for the state of Colorado in this is, I mean, you can say that that's not the church speaking, but that is so close to the church speaking, especially this is a church that wouldn't let you invite prominent Democratic speakers to BYU because we didn't want to endorse them. This double standard in gay rights that appears all over happening here is simply extraordinary. In the Roma brief, Rex Lee said that gay people didn't need special rights, that they were all rich and they didn't need special protection, that to allow laws prohibiting employment discrimination against people on the basis of sexual orientation would take away from more deserving minorities. That's a quote from Rex's brief. That's the special rights position, that laws that say you should not be able to fire a gay person, that you may not refuse service to a lesbian, that you cannot refuse housing to a gay man or a lesbian. Those are what are called special rights in this. In response to the Roma brief, the Supreme Court, to all of our surprise, voted 6-3 to uphold the Colorado decision and to reject Rex's brief. And in their decision, among the things they said was, there is nothing special about the protections which Amendment 2 takes away. These are rights that all Americans take for granted, either because they already have them or because they don't need them. Roma is a terribly important case because it rejects the special rights rhetoric. I represent to you that the church is a leading proponent of the proposition that civil rights are special rights and should be denied. Moving to a second situation where the church is directly involved, I have a pending case against Boy Scouts. It's an employment discrimination case against the Chicago Area Council, their policy against hiring avowed homosexuals. In Chicago, it's against law to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. Utah, the Hilton could refuse me water because they think I'm gay in Utah, and I would have no rights. In 41 states in the United States, you can be fired for being gay, including obviously here. There are no cities, no counties, no areas in the state of Utah where you have any civil rights protection on the basis of sexual orientation. Anyway, in Chicago we do. We sue the Boy Scouts. We're the only people currently winning against the Boy Scouts. And whenever we sue the Boy Scouts, the church always sends a spokesman. And in our case, it was Elder Jack Goslin, who's the head of the Young Men's Program. He was deposed a couple of years ago. The church... He was deposed. We have a lawyer, I'm sorry. That's what I mean. He's still in charge. The church owns 25% of all scouting units. It is by far the largest sponsor of Boy Scouts units. Because of the church's extraordinary leverage, it has single-handedly blocked all attempts to change the policy on women, the policy on children who won't say they believe in God, and the policy on gay people. Let me read you a couple of quotes from Jack. I mean, Elder Goslin. All my colleagues, they don't know all these Mormon terms, mystify them. So, question. What would be the impact on the relationship with the LDS Church if Boy Scouting were required by law to admit avowed homosexuals leaders as professional or volunteers? We would withdraw our charter membership from Boy Scouts of America. It's been discussed. When you say that it's been discussed, with whom has it been discussed? Quote, it's a decision made by the First Presidency and the Council of Twelve, the two ruling bodies of the church. Let me move to another page. Later on, it was asked, if the Boy Scouts hired a professional scouter, someone who had committed adultery or had premarital sex of any type, would the Mormon Church pull out of scouting? I don't think so. The church has a formal policy which says that if I win this lawsuit, they will pull out of Boy Scouting. And because of that policy, the Boy Scouts have vigorously opposed all efforts by anyone anywhere to open up the programs to gay men and lesbians or to gay and lesbian youth. When we talk about civil rights law, most people don't realize that I can be refused that glass of water. I mean, that's the problem that we have as gay rights activists and as lawyers, is it comes as a complete shock to most people, even most people here in the room, to know that there is nothing in the Constitution that prohibits discrimination. That's what civil rights laws do. In the 1960s, we passed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, which said that private businesses could not discriminate on the basis of race in housing, in public accommodations, like glass of water, and employment. That was later broadened. You can't discriminate on the basis of gender, of handicap, age. All of these are civil rights laws which have to be passed. Until a legislature gives that to us, the Hilton can take away that glass of water and I can't sue them. Nine states have passed such laws and over 200 communities. The practical matter, most people live in communities which are covered by laws like that, even though Illinois doesn't have a statewide act, Chicago does. New York State doesn't, New York City does. So it depends where you are. It's hit or miss, and if you're smart, you don't live in Utah. For lots of reasons. So the question is, the church said, according to Elder Hoffman, that it has not attempted to oppose basic civil rights for homosexuals. That it is true that the church currently doesn't have a formal policy on such laws, but it has an extraordinary effect. As Jay's discussion suggested, and as Dwight's suggestion about Arizona, and as the Hawaii experience says, The church doesn't have to have a foreign policy on these laws because it turns out that LDS legislators and LDS voters know what the policy is. When I was in Washington State 3 or 4 years ago, we tried for the 18th consecutive year to pass a statewide civil rights bill. And for the 18th consecutive year, we lost. And we were going over the roll call vote with some Democratic leaders, and we got to one of the Democrats, and it was Paul Shin. Well, why didn't he vote for it? And one of my colleagues turned to was like, what on earth is that going on? And then the light bulb went off. She said, oh, he's Mormon. I'm sure there are Mormon politicians out there who support civil rights. But it is shocking to see that Mormon Democrats, Mormon progressives, Mormons, people who are Christians, when faced with up or down votes on the obvious question that 80% of Americans support, that you shouldn't be able to fire someone just because they're gay, that the individual Mormons and Mormon leaders and lawmakers in Utah and elsewhere managed to block such laws. In Utah, it's just not an issue. I talked to Dave Nelson, the local activist, about this, and they don't even think about it, that everybody knows what the church's position. They don't even bring these votes up, that because all the church leaders, all of the local Republicans are just going to block it. It's just a given. I asked the church if they have a policy on civil rights laws the other day. I called church office building, and I asked what their policy was. I did. I said, I'm Roger Leishman. I'm with the ACLU. I read that the church opposes gay marriage. And does the church have a position on civil rights laws which prohibit discrimination in employment on the basis of sexual orientation? And Don LaFever said, I'll get back to you. And on Monday, he sent me his fax. Let me tell you what it says. There's three things. It says, quote, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has not taken a position on the specific example, on the federal civil rights legislation about which you inquired. That should be, if the church doesn't have a position and it's keeping out of politics, that's where it should end. But the letter, as you can see, is a little longer than that. He goes on, saying, first, however, the leadership has taken a position on the specific issue of proposed legalization of homosexual and lesbian marriage, and he quotes from the first presidency statement. I found that very interesting that I didn't ask about that. But he immediately changed the subject from the issue where 80% of Americans are in favor of protections to an issue that's new and where the 70% oppose. One of the reasons why it's hard to protect people's rights is because we have to change the subject and talk about more divisive things. And we get these arguments about the camel. This was the nose of the camel sticking through the tent, that if we start having hate crimes bills, if we say you can't bash gay people, then the next thing you know, we'll have to serve them glasses of water, and down the road, we're going to have to let them in the Boy Scouts, and ultimately, they're going to get married. So let's stop it at the hate crimes bill. I'm not surprised, but I'm impressed that immediately we have to say, and let's talk about marriage. But then he goes on in the same letter and says, The first president of the Council of the Twelve also said in a 1995 proclamation on the family, which many of you read, and I'll read it in its entirety, marriage is ordained of God, marriage between a man and a woman. It is the institution under which he designed that children should come into the world. Sexual relations under any circumstances become transgression, whether the relationship be heterosexual, homosexual, or whatever. Well, any such relationship outside the bonds of marriage is totally at odds with the teachings of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Homosexual, including lesbian, behavior is a deviation from the divine law in any age, regardless of its private toleration, popular promotion, or legal sanction. Society may redefine deviation, but God has not repealed his commandments. When you ask an organization that has aggressively participated in the anti-special rights movement whether they have a position on basic civil rights and employment discrimination, and they say, no, but God says that this is a deviation of divine laws, regardless of its legal sanction, and God has not repealed his commandments. That, to me, is so close to being an official position that it's meaningless to make these kind of distinctions. If the church is opposed to basic civil rights for homosexuals, then they should admit it. And I would tell you that the record of the statements and the actions of the leaders of the church and the church itself, throughout the last 20 years, have said that the church has opposed basic civil rights for gays and lesbians, and I don't think we should be able to permit them to deny that any further. And I think it's a terrible tragedy because, unlike these Keystone Cops lawsuits in Hawaii and dogpiling on the marriage issue where the presence of the Mormons, as Jay suggests, wasn't that much of an issue, I think the fact that your church is out there saying that you should be fired, that you shouldn't be allowed in the Boy Scouts, that you shouldn't be allowed to have a legal right to that glass of water, as long as that is the environment that we operate under, we will have and we will continue to have exactly what Dwight described, a culture and a state and a civilization where even if Dallin Oaks says it's wrong to hit someone because he's gay, Elder Packer said it was okay. And the people who actually go out and do the hitting know in their hearts that it's okay. Because God says, regardless of what the law says or how it changes, this is evil. My response to all of that is, this is dishonest, and also that it is evil. Thank you.
We have about 6 minutes for questions, and so I'll entertain them. Go ahead, Trey. Don't worry, we won't bash you.
The first one isn't fighting for same-sex marriage somewhat of like building a roof for the foundation? I mean, we're still not safe from housing and job discrimination in most jurisdictions. We still have gay-related hate crimes. We still, in most states, gay relationships are still illegal. In my home state of Virginia, a woman had her child taken away and given to her mother. Not because she was a bad parent, because she was a lesbian. I mean, no other reason except that she was a lesbian.
Trey, who are you addressing that question to?
Actually, all four of them.
Okay.
But it's a two-part question, because the second question is specifically to gay Mormons. You know, we're fighting the Mormon Church because they're opposing gay marriage. I mean, excuse the militaristic analogy, but sometimes it's better not to meet your enemy head-on, but to right-flank them. And why don't we go and take them to task when they say we do not oppose civil rights? And sometimes it's better to ignore the arguments of your enemy because they hate that more than when you argue with them. So I think we should just ignore their. I don't think. No, I don't agree with
you. Okay.
I think it's better just to ignore maybe their arguments against same-sex marriage because, in a sense, it is building a relationship. And fighting them on, or not fighting them, actually, not right-flanking them and going for the other rights that are actually very fundamental.
Let me answer that, and I'll try and do it real quick, and you guys can add something if you want. First off, I think we should and need to stand up and argue on the basis saying that we need and should have the right to marriage if we want it. And the reason being, first off, you need to say, we didn't pick this fight in time. If we had picked the battle, when we were going to do it, it would be 20 years from now, after we've gotten the protection in our job, after we've got protection from our kids being taken away from us, et cetera, et cetera. But we didn't pick that. It happened. It came out of the blue. And in the meantime, we have a marvelous opportunity to educate America and to make people realize that we are micromanaged in our lives. And that there's no reason to be. And most of America doesn't realize that right now. And so we need to take this opportunity to argue as hard as we can, knowing that we're going to lose in the short term. But in many ways, it's like the Equal Rights Amendment, because we lost the battle on equal rights. But women won many things in the process. They still aren't equal, but that was a good debate, and it helped them. Now, in terms of how you go about the church and where you battle the church, somebody said at one time, and I think it's great, that trying to organize gays and lesbians is like herding cats. Right? And frankly, that's true in most things. I mean, I'll say one thing about the Mormon Church is they sure know how to herd their cats. You know, they get those Mormons going directly in the right direction all the time. But the thing that I'm thankful for, right? The thing that I'm thankful for is that we do have gays and lesbians who are addressing these issues, and we're trying. And I know there's been meetings by the ACLU and other people to try and bring the church to task on being honest about what it's really doing. And I'd like to see more success on that. I'm not sure why, and that's one of the things we're trying to do here, is trying to bring that more to attention. Go ahead.
I stood up before Dwight had even, because this is not much different than what Dwight said. Tolstoy in War and Peace talks this huge movements going on in Europe during the Napoleonic times. And he's always showing the leaders of these nations and then showing that they were leaders because they got in front of the wave that went from west to east and the wave that went from east back west. Alexander, the Russian Tsar, did not lead the Russian soldiers to Paris. He just got in front and was pushed. We are in front of a movement because two pairs of women and one pair of men didn't want to wait any longer.
I guess I wasn't very effective, but what I was trying to say is that legislators in the legislatures, both in Congress, that is, well, as state legislatures, have done exactly what you suggested. Public opinion in America gives a certain latitude and boundaries with which legislators can act. And every public opinion poll in this country shows that the people are not ready for same-sex marriages. But in California, while they passed gave a due pass recommendation to the idea that we will not recognize same-sex marriages from Hawaii, they established domestic partnerships. Now the Republicans are not terribly sure they want that bill to pass. In the United States Congress, when the Republicans introduced the Defense of Marriage Act, Senator Kennedy in the Senate has now introduced an amendment to that prohibiting discrimination against gays in terms of employment. I think sometimes, my own view, as long as you take two steps forward and you just take one step back, you're making progress. And it seems to me that we need to use those kind of strategies, that when the right suggests that we prohibit something that we want, then I think we have to amend those bills and try to get passage of things that we really do, like getting rid of discrimination in employment.
Just for everybody's, so everybody understands, the session is pretty much over. I'm sure the tape has stopped.